Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Most of the food in your local supermarket, from packaged goods loaded with artificial ingredients and corn syrup, to meats fed on genetically modified crops, are the product of a cartel of multinational corporations. In today's edition of History Counts, we're going to examine how this food cartel came into being and what it means to you. And we'll also examine how the effort to control food relates to the infamous eugenics movement. So please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, Seeds of Destruction. Welcome to History Counts. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today, the leaders of a small group of very powerful corporations exercise a high degree of control over the food supply of the entire world. Who are they? How do they do it? And what does it mean for the rest of us? To help us address these important questions, we're very fortunate to have with us William Engdahl, author of Seeds of Destruction, which was published by the Center for Research on Globalization. Among the world's leading strategic analysts, Mr. Engdahl has written and spoken extensively on issues of geopolitics, economics, and energy. His writings have been translated into over a dozen languages. Mr. Engdahl, welcome to History Counts. Thanks very much for being with us today.
I'm happy to be here, Ken.
You note that in 1948, George Kennan, one of the U.S. leading foreign policy officials, noted that the United States, at the end of World War II, possessed a hugely disproportionate share of the world's wealth. Kennan said, quote, "Our real task in the coming period is to maintain this position of disparity." He added, quote, "We cannot afford the luxury of altruism." How did this view shape U.S. policy, including food policy, in the years following World War II?
Well, the Kennan quote summarizes, as best as any quote I've found, the mentality of the leading circles around what was then the New York Council on Foreign Relations, the leading foreign policy think tank of the East Coast establishment. And I'd go back a couple of years to 1939. In 39, the Council on Foreign Relations undertook a top-secret task force study called War and Peace Studies, and it was financed by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Rockefeller Foundation. The point of this was, and keep in mind, this was 1 month before the German tanks rolled into Poland and World War II at least formally began with Britain's declaration of war on Germany, that the United States leading circles like Walter Lippmann, Isaiah Bowman, then the president of Johns Hopkins University, and who was known as America's leading geopolitical theorist for Roosevelt, they got together and planned the post-war world. They said, there's going to be a war, it'll be a world war, and we have to start planning now for how the United States is going to assume the role that will be vacated by the collapse of the British Empire after the war. So already they were thinking in these terms, and they made a very clear policy that, unlike the British, they would not call their hegemony an empire. Rather, they would wrap it in the flag of altruism, of anti-colonialism, of the spread of the free enterprise system, of democracy. And to my mind, that was one of the most ingenious, brilliant strokes of geopolitical imperialism in history. But Kennan's point is, look, boys, let's not forget, we're not serious about this altruism. We're not serious about this support of democracy and so forth. This is just the cover. We're out there to maintain our share of the world pie. And we have to be nasty, we'll be nasty to do it. Well, if you look at the history of the last, let's say, 60, 65 years, that's pretty much the guiding philosophy if you strip away all the rhetoric.
And how does food policy relate to this?
Well, food policy has been a prime pillar of American foreign policies. Back in the 70s, Henry Kissinger, when he was presidential security advisor and secretary of state, developed the concept of food as a weapon. Now, Kissinger came out of the Rockefeller's table. He was an employee of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Council on Foreign Relations. back before he became Secretary of State and Security Council advisor of Nixon.
Your quote from him is that control the oil and you control nations, control the food and control the people.
Yeah, that really sums it up. And simultaneously, in the mid-70s, you had a oil crisis, an oil shock, really, a price shock, and you had a food crisis, which was Kissinger's terms of grain sales, unprecedented volumes of grain sales that were all negotiated by Cargill and the grain cartel companies of the U.S., Archer Daniels, Midland, Continental Grain was a player back then, Bunge. And what they did was sell the grain to Russia, which had had a harvest failure, at extraordinarily high prices, but the Russians had no choice, and they had to trade oil for grain. But what that did was it created a huge extension of the monopoly on grain trade internationally by Cargill and company, by the grain cartel. So at that point, this whole industrialization of agriculture took a giant leap forward to become not just a U.S. industrialization, but the beginning of a global industrialization. And it followed the template of the Rockefeller oil global monopolization process.
Rockefeller brothers loom very large in your book. Could you talk about their role in the Green Revolution, the Gene Revolution, and putting together this global agribusiness and how it relates to their earlier oil business?
The Rockefellers reasoned, okay, just as you mentioned the quote from Kissinger, control the oil, you control nations, control food, you control the people. They thought this would be a wonderful extension of their power reach if they could develop an industrialized, vertically integrated food chain internationally. And furthermore, they had huge reserves of nitrates and so forth that were used to produce bombs during the war, DuPont, Dow Chemical, all these large chemical Hercules powder. And they were wondering what to do with all this nitrate. Some of their staff came up with the idea of using this for chemical fertilizer for agriculture. And then, of course, they had a lot of oil sloshing around that there weren't yet markets in Europe because Europe was in a devastated state. So they said, let's industrialize agriculture in select parts of Mexico and the developing world. India was a big target of theirs. And through that industrialization, we'll introduce our fertilizers, our gasoline for the tractors and so forth. And only the big, largest farmers will be able to afford these kinds of inputs. So we'll tend to create a farm system, an agriculture system, that will tend to be similar to the latifundista system, the old feudal system in Latin America. So that was really the Green Revolution. The gains in crop productivity in the end of the day after two or three harvest years turned out to be quite the opposite. And it made these countries dependent on imports of fertilizer, later on imports of seed, not GMO seeds, but that came later. But the deed had been done and they were locked into the Rockefeller oil and fertilizer chemical industry.
Well, you noted other negative effects of the Green Revolution, the depopulation of the countryside.
Oh, it's devastating, yeah.
The increasing disparities of wealth, and also you have the introduction of large amounts of pesticides.
Yeah.
With the associated health problems.
And keep in mind, after 1945, four brothers had more power than any four human beings on the face of the earth, and they were Nelson, John D. III, Lawrence, and David Rockefeller. But those four brothers, the Rockefeller brothers, literally divided the world up after the war. John D. III took as population control his pet project and created the Population Council, birth control, all of these projects to reduce or control population growth. Nelson was the political figure. He went into the Eisenhower administration and later administrations to try to build the family's policies through government. And then David became the banker. He preferred to stay a little bit in the background and ended up being the most powerful of all the brothers.
And they essentially put together a giant cartel in which the oil companies, Standard Oil, was a part of it, but then you also had chemical companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical, and then the grain distributors like Cargill and Archer Daniels. So
right.
Together it was a very concentrated industry.
Oh, it was an extraordinarily powerful machine. You know, people talk about J.P. Morgan as the most powerful banker industrialist of American history, but he was really a minor player and literally played little or no influence after 1931, after the House of Morgan was split up by the Glass-Steagall Act in the Depression. And what emerged was the Rockefeller faction through their banking interest, Citigroup, Citibank at that time, and Chase Manhattan, or Chase Bank in the 50s. And then through the banking, that was kind of the linchpin of this whole industrial empire that went around the globe. What's important to realize is that it also is heavily tied into Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, the largest defense contractors. So the Rockefeller Group had simultaneously a huge interest in big oil, in big chemicals, and the military and industry complex.
Now, going back to the 1930s, the Rockefellers had a strong interest in the new field of molecular biology. Could you talk about that and then how it relates to the development of the gene revolution and genetically modified organisms?
Sure. The hegemonic discipline of biology today is something called molecular biology. And it's the pet Rockefeller University and Rockefeller Foundation dream back to the 20s when they were so fascinated with the idea of eugenics, getting rid of the unpure or the inferior races and, you know, breeding the pure race through genetic manipulation. So their idea was, if we can just reduce life to a single gene, you know, the DNA, RNA, the genome project, and then if you find the key to fiddle around with that gene, you can create a master race, or you can create a race that will self-destruct and commit termination on itself. So Warren Weaver and others at the Rockefeller Foundation back in 1938 began giving large research grants to biologists at Cambridge University and physicists around the world to develop this theory. And because they were one of the few private institutes that had money for this kind of research, of course, hungry scientists, hungry biologists began writing up grant proposals to get Rockefeller money. And that became a self-perpetuating, so that by the 50s, by the 60s, by the 70s, this was the dominant school of biology. And you had to keep in mind, Nelson Rockefeller was inside the U.S. government for a brief time, heading up the grant process at Health, Education, and Welfare Department, so he could give grants to universities furthering this research in molecular biology rather than ecological biology.
Well, how does a GMO plant differ from an ordinary plant, and what advantage would the Rockefellers and their associates see in developing a GMO plants?
The difference is the following. You bombard a normal seed, let's say a seed of a certain variety of corn, with a foreign bacteria or a foreign entity. You bombard it, and it's an incredibly crude process. It's hit and miss, fiddle stick or not stick, like throwing mud on the wall. Then if it sticks and you have a trait, then you try to reproduce that seed, and then you immediately patent it for certain traits. For example, you want it to be resistant to the European corn borer, an insect that eats corn crops. So they advertise this as seeds that will allow you to grow corn as a farmer, but have absolutely picture book green stalks on your corn and so forth, and the uniform height. There'll be no insect damage whatsoever. The other traits you can breed it for is that it's, the main one is that it's resistant to a herbicide, one of the most toxic herbicides known, and it's the most widely used herbicide. I bet many of your listeners use this without knowing in their home gardens. It's called Roundup, and it's patented and distributed by Monsanto. There's some people who say they think that Monsanto developed Roundup-ready soybeans, Roundup-ready corn, and so forth, the seeds that would be resistant to the toxic effects of their Roundup herbicide, in order that you have to buy the both as a package in order to grow your crops.
So you buy the seeds, you buy the Roundup herbicide.
Yeah, you have to buy the Roundup, otherwise you have a huge problem with weeds.
And I understand that most of the world's livestock is now fed with the GMO soybean.
Yeah, there are three countries which are overwhelmingly dominating the world soybean market, and those are the United States, Brazil, and Argentina. The first guinea pig project for mass production of soybeans back in the 90s was in Argentina under the regime of Carlos Menem, and Monsanto, under the table, managed to wrangle a sweetheart deal where they have exclusive rights to sell Monsanto-patented Roundup-ready soybean seeds, and Roundup, of course, in Argentina. So This all went on during the debt crisis, which Chase Manhattan Bank of David Rockefeller played a key role in manipulating this debt crisis. So under the crisis of debt, the IMF comes in, says devalue the Argentine peso massively so that you can export. And what are you going to export and earn dollars for? Well, soybeans. Soybeans are in big demand now for agriculture feed around the world and the European Union. China, there's a growing market for imported soybeans, etc. So that's exactly what happened. Argentina today, 97% of all their soybeans are genetically manipulated, and they're made by Monsanto. These seeds are patented by three or four giant agribusiness multinationals, and the overwhelming seeds of the world right now are in their hands. And three of those, Monsanto, DuPont, and Dow Chemical, their GMO offshoots, have decades-long intimate relation with Pentagon chemical warfare, secret chemical warfare programs like Agent Orange in Vietnam, the dioxin scandals and so forth, where Monsanto desperately tried to cover up the toxic effects of these chemicals on their own workers. They lied to the courts, they manipulated their test results and so forth. So these same companies are now telling us, trust us with the world seed heritage, trust us with the future food harvest of the world. We're a good citizen, we're a good player, and we'll take care of the world, don't worry. Well, I worry, and I'm not about to trust Monsanto with the future of my family's seed supply.
Could you talk about the work on GMOs of Dr. Arpad Pusztai?
He was the leading and most respected research biologist doing research on the effects of genetic manipulation on rats. He did studies, control studies, because at the time he started them, he told me this, he was an excited proponent of the advance of science. He thought this was a real step forward. And he wanted to show the world that this was safe and had no adverse effects. So he did a very rigorous control study with rats at Rowett Institute, which is a British government institute in Scotland, at the time very respected institute. And after 3 months, he became so alarmed with the test results, he went to his chief and said, I think we have to go public with this. This is alarming. What he found, and he did go public on Channel 4 national television in Britain, it got picked up all around the world, the first scientific study that showed that the effects of a concentrated diet of GMO potatoes on rats created dramatic organ shrinkage, including liver, heart, and most alarming, he was so alarmed by this, he didn't dare to say it in public, the brains shrank. So 48 hours of going public, his boss came in and told him he was to clean his desk out, leave his computer, all his disks. They were now the property of Rowett Institute. He was to talk to none of his colleagues ever again about his research, nor to the press. He was totally muzzled. He found out years later from a former colleague that it was Tony Blair, then the Prime Minister of Britain, who got a telephone call from none other than Bill Clinton in Washington. And Bill Clinton, it turned out, had gotten a phone call from Monsanto saying, shut this guy Pusztai up, he's threatening the whole project. And that's exactly what happened.
Now, the issues of food policy and population control, which you've alluded to earlier, came together in a secret memo drafted in the 1970s by Henry Kissinger, and it was entitled Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. Can you talk about this memo and how it relates to the Rockefellers' involvement in the eugenics movement in the United States and Germany going way back to the early 1900s?
Well, this was a profound turning point in U.S. government foreign policy, the first time explicitly in history that the U.S. government had population control of other countries as a national security policy. Keep in mind, Kissinger is a product of the Rockefeller farm, and Kissinger got the project essentially from a report that John D. Rockefeller, the Population Council fanatic, John D. Rockefeller III, had given to Nixon. Nixon was not too eager to make population and birth control a big political issue, so he kind of downplayed it. But then as soon as Nixon was out of the way, Kissinger brought this document out called NSSM 200, National Security Strategic Memorandum, and made population control in developing countries a national security policy of the United States. Why? The argument was interesting. He said, we're in a Cold War, and this is a challenge for the future of the planet. Who's going to dominate, the United States or Russia? And in that Cold War, there are developing countries which have strategic minerals, strategic raw materials, oil and other things that are absolutely strategic for this Cold War. And if those countries, Indonesia, Brazil, they had a whole list of 13 priority countries, if those countries decide to not do anything about controlling their birth rates, well, they're going to have growing, dynamic, young populations that are going to want a piece of the pie. They're not going to be satisfied with their leaders just exporting all their raw materials to us. They're going to want to use those raw materials for national development. Well, it's certainly their right to do so, but Kissinger didn't see it that way. So they made a precondition for U.S. AID, you know, U.S. foreign aid, for these priority countries like Brazil et al. They made a precondition that they have in place an effective population control policy, birth control policy. And they went into great detail. It all came from John D. Rockefeller.
How does this all relate to the American Eugenics Society, which the Rockefellers funded earlier?
The American Eugenics Society actually was created back, well, even before the 20s, but it grew to prominence in the 1920s. But the idea of eugenics is, it's like with horses. Actually, it grew out of the Horse Breeders Association of these wealthy people. But it was Carnegie, the great steel baron. Rockefeller was one of the leading funders, the Harriman family, Avril Harriman, the banking family, and Colgate of the Colgate-Palmolive Corporation. And some of the wealthiest families in America got behind this eugenics idea because they said, well, this gives us a justification to demand forced sterilization of inferior people.
And they, in fact, implemented that in the Rockefeller Population Council campaign in Puerto Rico, you're right, in the 1950s.
Oh, this was a scandalous, almost genocidal in dimensions, what they did in Puerto Rico. This was their laboratory to test things, because Puerto Rico didn't have any status as a state, and it didn't have any national sovereignty. It was this in-between entity. And the Rockefeller family, they built Eastern Airlines as a boxcar shuttle between Puerto Rico and the New York Garment District, where you could have cheap labor flown in at a low cost to work the garment industry in Manhattan. But then they got the idea of doing forced sterilizations of women, tying their tubes after they would give birth to the second child. And they did this through encouraging hospitals in rural areas, clinics actually. And then they did a propaganda campaign telling these peasant families that it's much safer if you go to the doctor here in our new clinic. It's more sanitary, everything else. And what the doctors wouldn't tell them is that they were making it impossible for them to have another child after the birth of the second child.
You noted that the Public Health Department of Puerto Rico reported in 1965 that 35% of Puerto Rican women of childbearing age had been sterilized.
And most of them didn't understand what had been done. They thought it was just part of the childbirth.
Another interesting connection you note with respect to the Rockefeller-funded Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany was that that institute's leading psychiatrist, Ernst Rudin, became an architect of Hitler's medical eugenics program, including forced sterilization.
Yeah. The money that financed eugenics and forced sterilization studies during the Third Reich, from 1933 to 1939, came from the Rockefeller Foundation. It came through their Paris offices, their facsimiles of the telegrams authorizing the expenditures that I have in the book. And the Rockefellers, leading members of the board of the Rockefeller Foundation, would go to Germany to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute and interview Hitler's eugenicists and come back and say, son of a gun, it's really a shame that the Third Reich has such a bad public image, because they're doing what we only talk about doing over there in Germany. They're really sterilizing the people. This is the mentality of these families.
The Rockefeller interest in population control and the development of GMOs come together in a recently developed new seed called Epicyte, a spermicidal corn. Could you talk about that?
In 2001, the president of Epicyte held a press conference, and he was quite excited. I think genuinely he thought he had really contributed to one of the world's leading problems, namely the birth of human beings by developing a spermicidal corn. He said, I have a greenhouse back behind me here that's full of spermicidal corn. We have developed a technique so that men, males that eat this corn, become infertile. Their sperm is essentially killed off. So that, imagine places like Mexico, where eating corn-based tortillas and such things are a staple diet for most Mexicans, that they would have this spermicidal corn without knowing it, and suddenly you wouldn't have any Mexican babies around anymore after a few years.
What are the consequences to you and me and everyone else that a small group of corporations exercises such control over the world's food supply?
Well, I think we have to take another dimension of this whole thing, Ken, equally as important as the genetic manipulation and the patenting of the seeds. The Rockefeller family funded something at Harvard Business School, and the two professors that led the project for agribusiness created the term agribusiness. And their idea was to create a vertical integration model, at that time against U.S. law that were passed during the Chicago meatpacking scandals in the 20s, that agriculture could be vertically integrated from top to bottom, from the source of supply to the distribution and marketing and so forth. So that was the beginnings. It actually started with the production of chickens and orange juice in the 1950s as a project of the Harvard Business School. And Ray Goldberg and John Davis, who was Eisenhower's assistant agriculture secretary, cartelize and monopolize all of the key aspects of food production to the point where in the United States today, which is unfortunately the world's leading example of industrialized food, almost everything Americans eat is industrialized food product, with corn gluten, with all these synthetics added, with these synthetic flavorings and so forth. And the nutritional value of this food is atrocious, but that's not a factor, because under agribusiness, there's only one factor: shareholder value of the stockholders in the corporation, whether it's Monsanto or whether it's Archer Daniels Midland or Iowa Beef, Smithfield Foods for pigs, and so forth.
Should steps be taken to reduce the agribusiness control over food? And if so, what steps would you like to see taken?
Oh, I think vertical integration of agriculture ought to be immediately forbidden. We ought to return to the laws that were perfectly justifiable from back in the 1920s and force a divestment of these vertically integrated monopolies. You have four or five giant companies controlling the meat supply. You have three or four companies controlling the seeds. You have three or four companies controlling the trade in the seeds internationally. And years ago, we had an antitrust law on the books, but it's used against labor unions, but not against these kind of corporate conglomerates. So I think it simply has to be rolled back if we're going to have a healthy next few generations. So the way things are going, the epidemic of obesity, the epidemic of allergies among our children in the last 10, 15 years is a direct product, there's no question about it, from various scientists that have looked at it, of the industrialization of our food supply.
Mr. Engdahl, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking with William Engdahl about his book, Seeds of Destruction, which describes how a small group of powerful corporations have gained control over the world's food supply. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. Mr. Engdahl says that today's population control program is essentially a continuation of the pre-World War II eugenics movement. In 1952, John D. Rockefeller III, whose family had funded the American Eugenics Society, created a new organization called the Population Council to promote similar objectives. The first president of the Population Council was Rockefeller associate Frederick Osborne, a past president of the American Eugenics Society. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs, see a schedule of upcoming shows, and sign up for our monthly newsletter and podcasts. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.